Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. First off, I just want to say congratulations to making it to the final chapter. We are on chapter 33, the last chapter of our textbook, even though I know a lot of you haven't read the textbook, just listen to these, but that is okay. But we are done. This is our last set of notes. Be excited. Be happy. This chapter is going to talk about globalization, which we started talking about last class. We're going to finish that in our final content class. And it's going to talk about the new millennium. So we're really starting at 1990 forward and all the events that happened, the changes in the economy, changes in politics, changes in culture, and things like that. So before we start, again, congratulations on getting this far. And we've had a great year. And we are about to start reviewing. And we're gonna have a good time. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on. Section 1, global political economies. A, the spread of democracy. 1, democracy has a lot of appeal to many people, and we do see that it allows for the peaceful resolution of differences between a country's social, political, cultural, and regional groups. So democracy is very beneficial system that helps pretty much everybody. I mean, there's bad things about democracy, but for the most part, there's a lot of good things. There's more, the good outweigh the bad. 2, democratic institutions gained ground in many Eastern European and Russian regions during the 90s. Remember the fall of communism, late 80s, early 90s, complete dissolution. Now they have to rebuild. They have to have a more democratic government. 3, since 1991, democracy will become the norm in Latin America. 4, in Asia, Indonesia, and China, we do see a move towards more political processes with the election of the BJP in India. It's just a new political organization. That would increase tensions between India and Pakistan. So India and Pakistan, remember, split in the late 40s, 1947, I believe. They split and Pakistan became its own country. Pakistan just used to be northern India, but they split off, and this would cause further tensions, just political tensions between the two countries, and of course just continued tensions between Hindus and Muslims in India. 5, with the exception of South Africa, so we're not talking about South Africa, elections in other parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, more often than not, have been used by dictators as the first step to establishing military authoritarianism or political dominance. 6, democracy, of course, always remember, is the exception. Not everywhere submits to democracy. And that's especially the case in the Middle East. 7, in addition to internal factors, the changed politics of the Cold War era and the demands for a more globalized economy would force people to play very important roles in contributing to the growth or the decline of democracy in various countries. So we're either seeing the rise of democracy or a decline of democracy. Section B, global politics. 1. So since the end of the Cold War, we do see that the United Nations sought to reestablish its role as the peacekeeper of the world and the defender of human rights. But we do see that there's some difficulty on the members agreeing on how to go about doing that and what course of action they should take when being human rights advocates and policing entity. 2, it also has been difficult for this international organization to agree on how to intervene in civil disputes within specific countries. This was definitely illustrated and shown with how slow the United States and European nations were to respond to the ethnic cleansing, which is just like a genocide, of Muslims in Yugoslavia and the Tutsis community in Rwanda. C, arms control and terrorism. 1, so we do see that recent events, not recent as in our time, but events in the 90s and the, of course, major event in 2001 saw in increasing concerns about terrorism and how the dissemination of WMDs, remember, weapons of mass destruction, are spread about. Two, the United States and many other countries began to increase their nuclear weapon capabilities and their programs as a result of this like tense situation. Three, we also see that there are many fears by many nations about weapons of mass destruction and increased terrorism. And those nations and fears would all come together in concern about terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda or Taliban by leaders like Osama bin Laden. And they were afraid that those organizations were going to gain those WMDs. Four. During Bush's administration, he makes a declaration saying we are at a war on terrorism or the war on terror. And he makes the first strike by the United States on Afghanistan and Iraq. And this just raises fears in the rest of the world that the United States was no longer going to like play by international organizations or international law. So a lot of people freaked out. Five. The disorder and the chaos that was started in Iraq following the invasion by the U.S. intensified the worldwide debate about what we should do as a global community to respond to threats of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. D, the global economy. One. So after the collapse of socialist economies in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, they were quickly replaced by free market capitalism, and they saw that as the only way to grow economically. Two, we do see that there is a worldwide recession beginning in 2000 following the 90s, which was a decade of rapid growth economically. Three, we also see that world trade and manufacturing are increasingly becoming interdependent of one another, meaning that they have to work together or be combined in order to be successful. Like, you can't manufacture something and not trade it internationally. It kind of goes hand in hand. Like, I don't know what goes hand in hand. Peanut butter jelly? I don't know. Anyway, you can't have one without the other. Four, we also see a rapid growth occur in the developing world as many countries are transitioning from communism to capitalism. When you go from a very controlled economy to a more open, free economy, it's going to increase drastically and in a crazy fast way. Five, at the same time, China is also making steps to open its economy, having more free trade, more free investment to become a more global economic power. Six, we do see that with the advancement in technology, it made it possible to quickly invest funds in the international market, while at the same time being able to quickly withdraw those funds just as fast. Seven, the year 2000 to 2001, we would see a huge economic slowdown from 13% to 1%, which is crazy. So it decreased by 12%. That's crazy in 1 year. And eight, the short-lived boom of the 1990s really did not do anything to change the disparities between the rich and the poor in the world. Section E, managing the global economy. One, in order to promote economic growth, many countries began to form free trade zones and regional trade associations or agreements. So we do see the strengthening of the European Union, as well as the creation of NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement. And these were examples of this kind of trend of increasing economic growth. And the EU is the European Union, remember. NAFTA is no longer. Now we are starting to see a new entity being formed by Trump and his administration between Canada and Mexico and the US, but we don't know what that is officially yet. Two. We also have another organization called the World Trade Organization, or the WTO. It was founded in 1995, and it encouraged reduced trading barriers and to enforce international trade agreements. Three, we also have another organization called the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And these were basically institutions that would provide assistance to countries who were in economic trouble. But more often than not, in order for you to gain assistance, you had to make a lot of political changes or very unpopular political changes in order to gain that assistance. So kind of like a reassurance for the lenders. Like, if we're going to lend you something, you got to change all this because obviously what you were doing was wrong and you need our help. 4, in light of increased criticism, we do see world leaders pledge to do more to help the world's poorer nations. And 5, one example of this is President Bush's Millennium Challenge account, and this is meant to encourage economic growth in poor nations. Section 2, trends and visions. A new age. 1, so we have this an analyst and reporter named Thomas Friedman, and he says that the 1990s ushered in this huge new economic and political age that had never been seen before in the world or in history. 2, Friedman believed that global integration or globalization would produce both economic support and communal social values. Like, we would all have the same values, we all have the same ideas and things like that that we share. 3, unfortunately, with the events of 9/11, we had the economy greatly impacted. There was an economic slowdown, and now many people began questioning his ideas and saying, maybe you shouldn't have been too positive because obviously we're all not on the same page. B, Christian millenarianism. 1. At the end of the 90s, beginning at the year 2000, we do see many Christians saw deeper meaning in in the turn of the 21st century. And they believed that Jesus Christ and the end of the world were happening, that Jesus was going to come back and the end of the world was going to happen in 2000. 2, such individuals or Christian millenarians see current events as evidence of the coming apocalypse. So they would use the 9/11 attack, or they'd use all these natural disasters or epidemics or pandemics as, you know, steps towards the apocalypse. C, militant Islam. 1. So we do have a variety of people of multiple faiths are inclined to see the contemporary world in religious terms. So, like, Christians are seeing it in religious terms, Muslims are seeing it, Jewish people are seeing it. Everybody who has a religion sees the world, not all of them, but people see it through their religion. 2, like people of all faiths, like anybody, Muslims have responded in multiple ways towards globalization: positive, negative, neutral, independent. A small minority, have chosen a militant response to what they see as a threat to Islam and a threat to their way of life. Now, I say minority, and I'm going to say it 2 more times. Minority. A small section of Islam and followers of Islam believe this, that they need to have violence in order, or perpetrate violence in order to protect themselves because they feel threatened. 3, economic and political failures have contributed, of course, to the rise of this militant Islamic movement. Of course, conflict with Israel and the unhappiness about the American support of Israel have, of course, increased anger in the Middle East. And militant Muslims believe that violence against their enemies is justified because they see themselves as in this global battle between good and evil, and they're good and the United States and the West are evil. D, universal rights and values. 1, so the United Nations sought to protect the rights of individuals through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was passed in December of 1948, so after World War II, at the General Assembly. The declaration emphasized individual rights, was derived mostly from European and American history, and many of the countries that later signed had reservations about this global or universal nature of concepts that had been formulated more on Western culture than on international culture. Two, rather than addressing these philosophical issues regarding human rights, activists began to work through NGOs, which are non-governmental organizations, and would focus their efforts on agreed upon violations of human rights. This would be like torture, imprisonment without trial, execution by death squads, famine relief, and refugee assistance. Three, demands by the United States that citizens be exempted from the jurisdiction of International Criminal Court and its withdrawal from the Kyoto Agreement has prompted charges of hypocrisy from critics of the U.S. government. So the United States and the Americans wanted to be exempt from International Criminal Court and the Kyoto Agreement, which is just like, you know, everybody's like countries are upheld by international law and things like that. Now that if you act on it, if you're committing genocide, if you're doing these like mass terror things and all that stuff, of course you're going to be upheld for something, right? You have to be held accountable. Section E, women's rights. One. So the position on the question of women's rights demonstrated a dichotomy of views, meaning opposing views between Western industrialized nations and Africa, Asia, and Latin America. So we have different views. We have Western views and then we have more traditional views. Two, the movement, the feminist movement in the West was concerned with voting rights, equal access to education, jobs, and the end of gender discrimination and sexual exploitation. Feminists of the West also decried the oppression of women in other parts of the world. Three, non-Western women complained about the deterioration of morality and family life in the West and questioned the priorities of Western feminist movement. Basically, they're saying, you guys don't have any morals, you guys are just breaking down the family and traditional values, like, what is your goal? Like, you just want all this, but what are you trying to do? You know, like, they're confused. So efforts to coordinate the struggle for women's rights internationally would gain momentum in the 70s, but these efforts were not able to overcome cultural disagreements on the definition of women's rights. So women's rights are going to be different in the U.S. than they are in, let's say, Nigeria, or they're going to be different than the rights movement in, let's say, like Argentina. It's just going to be different. Section 3, global culture. A, the media and the message. 1. So after World War II, we do see the United States become the world's main exporter of movies, and they're only challenged by India, Egypt, and Hong Kong for that market. 2. The 1960s, television became king, and it began to spread to most of the non-Western world, where government monopolies ensured that the new media could be used to unify national viewpoint rather than as a transmission of Western culture. American organizations like MTV, Music Television, that's where that comes from, MTV, and CNN, or the cable news network, would use satellite transmission technology to enter the international market. MTV would create special editions to adapt to the taste of local markets, but CNN provided basically an American view of the news, so a biased view. 3. The development of digital technology offered possibilities of combining separate technologies of movies, TV, and computers, and the development of the internet would also help to transform business and education. So these innovations, TV, movie, computers, internet, could be seen as portents of Western and American cultural domination. But as technology became more widespread, we do see people around the world adapting the technology for their own purposes. B, the spread of pop culture. 1. So because of these new technologies, we do see they helped change perceptions of culture by allowing pop culture to become more and more visible internationally. So at the beginning of the 20th century, early 20th century, that's the 1900s, European composers, choreographers, writers, artists all drew on popular culture to inspire their work. The invention of the phonograph was the key to opening global audiences. The phonograph is like a record player. They would spread American culture, jazz, blues, rock and roll all over the world. 3. Mass production and advertising would open the door to the spread of popular culture, the consumer products from America, Europe, and Japan. Transnational companies would find their way into the international market. C. Emerging global culture. Okay. 1. Cultural links across national and ethnic boundaries would generate less controversy than the globalization of popular culture. So Russian-American collaboration on space missions and in the business world and the flow of graduate students from around the world to American scientific labs and, of course, English becoming a global language were all aspects of globalization at the elite level. 2. The importance of English as a global language is evident in the emergence of an international literature in English. So English is, like they were saying, it's an elite language. If you speak English, then it tends to be that you're more educated, that you have more means or whatever. The one that's really creeping up, especially because of the business world, is Mandarin, is becoming a huge language that you need to know for business nowadays. 3. Western universities have also become the model for higher education around the world. That's why if you come from another country, say I'm from China and I have a PhD, I'm a professor over in China. If I come over here, my degree may not transfer or my credentials may not transfer because they might not be on par to American universities. Now, where the United States lacks in public education, so their K-12 education system is way behind other countries. Their college institutions are by far the best of any other country, which is kind of backwards. We would want to have a very good foundation, right? But we don't see it as that way, I guess. That's not a priority. D, enduring cultural diversity. 1. So we do see the world is filled with diverse cultural traditions that at the end of the 20th century, despite globalization of industrialization and integration of economic markets, persisted. So diversity is always going to be something. We're all different. No one is the same. So we're going to always have a diverse society. Japan, for example, has been a success in the modern industrial world in spite of its group-oriented hierarchical approach to social reforms. And it's very homogeneous, homonormative community. Like, it's really hard to become a citizen in Japan if you're not Japanese. Everybody is basically the same. They don't really have a large, diverse population. A country that has a large, diverse population beside the United States would be like Britain. Britain has a huge, diverse population. People from all over the world live in Britain. And the difference between that and other countries like Japan, Japan is very single ethnic group. You don't see a lot of outsiders in Japan as you would say in like France or in America or in Britain. 2. The economic success of Japan and other Asian countries call into question this long-standing Western assumption that all of world history culminated in the convergence of political freedom, secularization, and industrialization that began in the West. We now see that that's, I mean, Japan and Asia are challenging the status quo. Also, we are coming into question was whether industrialization offered the only viable route to prosperity. So was industrialization the only way to get where we were? Or could there have been other ways? So it leaves the question there open to interpretation of what we think could happen. Or we think may have been different if we didn't industrialize. But that's a totally different conversation. But that is the final section. Congratulations on getting through your final chapter, and we will begin reviewing as soon as possible. I'll see you guys later. Good afternoon.